Hey, I'm Jesse from Dallas. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me. You should support the show like I did. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Along with the huge success of his sketch comedy show Key & Peele, maybe you've noticed my guest Keegan-Michael Key has been taking on more dramatic roles, stuff like Fargo and Tomorrowland. It's no fluke. He has a master's degree in theater from Penn State, but he says his dramatic training started way before that.
I probably already did my 10,000 hours by the time I was 13. I remember being in a neighbor's basement, and I was downstairs dancing. And I remember, to this day, it's one childhood memory that I have, feeling wonderfully free while I was dancing. And then someone came up to me and said, "What are you doing? What is something wrong with you? There's something wrong with this child." So it shut me down. And then in your mind, you start to put an encyclopedia. Okay, so I better watch them, because that was the most horrible feeling I've ever experienced emotionally. So I better just figure out what they're doing and then do what they're doing. And so, yes, I think both Jordan and I are very facile at taking the cultural temperature of a moment and figuring out how do we rise or lower to that temperature. It's been the pathology's been useful.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to President Obama's official anger translator about race and comedy.
Do the funniest thing. Discover the funniest thing. That's the mantra. That's the golden rule. And then everybody can say what they want, and pundits can talk about how it's racial or not racial, or it's black or it's not black enough. I can't concern myself with that too much.
Then later I'll talk to Titus Burgess from The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and 30 Rock. Burgess was a Broadway star before he got into TV comedy. He knows how to roll with the punches, like the time that he sang a solo at the Tony Awards with a broken microphone.
It wasn't until I got finished with the performance and got my phone out and had all these missed calls and texts and such, and people were like, "Oh my God, what happened to your microphone?" or whatever. And then I freaked out. I wasn't nervous while it was happening. I freaked out after the fact.
And I'll tell you about Chevy Chase's greatest achievement, Fletch, which Peter Sagal just told me he hates, but he can stick it in his ear. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Keegan-Michael Key is a comic actor who throws all of himself into every role. His work's sometimes big, but it's always very specific. First on Mad TV, now as half of Comedy Central's Key & Peele, he's made his name as one of the best sketch comics in the country. He's the kind of guy who can imbue life into even the briefest characterizations, no matter how ridiculous they might be.
Jamar is Jamar, Javaris and Lamar, University of Middle Tennessee.
He's one of the stars of USA's great sitcom Playing House, and he's been in a bunch of films as well. This summer, he was a music executive in Pitch Perfect 2, which is now officially one of the biggest comedy hits of all time. He even performed with Barack Obama at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He played his Key & Peele character, the anger translator for the president, Luther.
Despite our differences, we count on the press to shed light on the most important issues of the day.
And we can count on Fox News to terrify old white people with some nonsense. Sharia law is coming to Cleveland, run for the damn hills. Y'all's ridiculous.
Let's take a listen to a clip from Key & Peele. This is the first appearance of Mr. Garvey, who is a substitute teacher with years of experience teaching in inner city schools, who is in this sketch teaching a classroom of what look like suburban white kids.
Let's take a roll here. Jay Quellen. Where's Jay Quellen at? No Jay Quellen here?
Do you mean Jacqueline?
Okay, so that's how it's gonna be. Y'all wanna play. Okay, then. I've got my eye on you, Jay Quellen. Balake. Where is Balake at? There's no Balake here today. Yes, sir.
My name's Blake.
Are you out of your mind?
Blake.
What? Do you want to go to war, Balaki?
No.
Because we could go to war.
No.
I'm for real. I'm for real. So you better check yourself. D-Nice. Is there a D-Nice? If one of y'all says some silly ass name, this whole class is gonna feel my wrath. Now, D-Nice.
Do you mean Denise?
Oh, no.
Keegan Michael Key's been nominated for an Emmy for the show. Andy, his other show, Playing House, just came back to USA. Keegan Michael Key, welcome back to Bullseye. Great to see you.
Thank you, Jesse.
I love the way that sketch inverts this expectation of someone coming into a bunch of poor people of color and fixing them.
Right. It's reverse Dangerous Minds.
Yeah.
Reverse Dangerous Minds. In fact, in my mind, I have always fancied that Mr. Garvey has a military background. Mm-hmm. It only right now at this moment occurred to me, oh, that was Michelle Pfeiffer's thing. She was a Marine. Which was always weird. You're like, come on.
Michelle Pfeiffer's character was a Marine in Dangerous Minds?
Yes. She was a member of the United States Marine Corps. And that was what made her tough enough to be able to handle the schools. You know what I mean? But that's I think that got in my mind when I made, because there's something very martial about Mr. Garvey. And but also, that's always been a thing that we wanted to do in the show in the first couple of seasons. All we ever talked about was Jordan made up this term, comedic judo. So what you do is you subvert the expectation, right? So they're like, the best one is probably the movie heckler sketch we did, where you're going, why would they do this sketch? This is so unoriginal. I've seen black guys talking to the movie theater, but you've never seen black guys that have master's degrees in film doing that. You know what I mean? It's that little whip, little zigzags or double zags. And sometimes we get double zags, which is good.
What kind of schools did you go to?
I went to Catholic schools mostly. I went to 16 straight years of Catholic education from first grade to my senior year of college.
Were you raised Catholic, or did you just go to Catholic?
No, raised Catholic. Oh yeah, my father converted his entire family from Baptist to Catholic. He went to Utah State University in Logan, Utah. He was one of two black students in the entire school. It was 1963, and he met a Monsignor at a place called the Newman Center, and the Monsignor took him under his wing, because my dad was living a relatively isolated life. You're trying to make do, but he's a 6'4", 210-pound black man on the campus on an agriculture.
How did he end up there?
Well, my grandparents left Tennessee when he was about 10 years old, and they moved to Salt Lake. My grandfather played in the Negro Leagues, and they met, and then they were like, we got to get out of Memphis. So they left, and my great-grandfather, my maternal great-grandfather, he worked at a speakeasy in Salt Lake City, which makes him a real badass. Because an African-American man who works in a speakeasy in a dry state in 1958 or 56, but my grandma said, I guess it was that bad in Memphis that they had to go to Salt Lake City, Utah.
Well, I'm imagining like a police officer interrogating, like, can you describe the man who was running the speakeasy?
Right.
I honestly don't. He was about 6'4".
Yeah, exactly.
I can't think of any other distinguishing characteristics
whatsoever. And my grandma said, what's a speakeasy? She read in an article that I had said this. I was like, grandma, no need to be coy. And she goes, well, we called that a dinner club. And I used to wear an apron, and it had little slots in it. And you could put shots in the slots, and then you would sit down. It was customary to sit down to take the order, and then you would pass drinks underneath the table just in case there were any G-men around to bust the establishment. And so that's and then my grandfather worked at Mack Truck. He was a janitor at Mack Truck in Salt Lake City, because so many of the trucks are manufactured in that part of the country, because there's just truck stops all over Wyoming and Utah and northern Arizona. And so they moved there, and then my dad just grew up there, with his siblings. So it was pretty much my family and maybe one other black family. It was really like 12 black people in the state. And so he went to Utah State University to go get his social working degree.
So you come from basically a long line of of multiculturally fluent people.
Oh yeah, and I haven't even opened the can of worms. This is just my adoptive family. This is just the couple that adopted me. We're not even talking about my biological family. And then my parents, you know, parents divorced, and my dad married a woman from Northern Ireland. And so, yeah, it's my life's this very wonderful hodgepodge of cultural experiences. And I would say the same thing, you know, Jordan's from Manhattan. So enough said. Everybody you know, it's a different cultural landscape than me being from Detroit, where most of my friends, you know, a lot of my friends I grew up with, most of my friends are white working class people or white middle class people, you know.
Did you feel self-conscious about race when you were in high school and you had mostly white friends?
100%. Oh, yeah. Grade school was tough because when I started grade school, the demographic of the school was probably 50% white and 50% black. By the time I graduated from that same grade school, it was 95% black. And I just – the things that I like – everything becomes very intensely emotional and personal. It has nothing to do with not liking black people or being ashamed of black people. I'm an emotional person. I could even go so far as to say I'm relatively fragile. I didn't have the bluster that the kids that I went to school with had or the cockiness. Like if I was covering somebody while we were playing football and they caught the football, I go, good job. Whereas they would look at me and go, in your face, and I just didn't – I'm like, but why? Why would you do that?
White guys saying that?
No, I'm saying in grade school with all the black guys. And it's so and I was just like, I don't understand why – but why are we being mean to each other? It's a cultural thing. It's trash talking. Yeah, I don't know. I don't understand the efficacy of it. Why are we doing it?
What did you feel like you were supposed to do?
I felt like I was supposed to, for lack of a better term, because it's the one that we use as shorthand in the States, that I was supposed to act black or be black. And it got worse in college. Like in college, a lot of people in college called me an Oreo and why do you behave this way and why do you act white? Why do you talk white?
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Keegan-Michael Key. He's currently Emmy-nominated in 5 categories for his TV sketch show, Key and Peele. There's a great sketch, I think it was in this last season, where Jordan is singing bass in an otherwise all-white a cappella group.
Yeah.
And you kind of come in. You're just like a goofy buddy of one of the guys.
Of one of the other guys, yeah.
And you come in and sort of top his soulful, extemporaneous filigree at the end. And then everybody kind of goes home and the two of you – well, in fact, let's take a listen.
Sure,
to
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Our love is here to stay. Ooh, each and why? Every day. Ooh, we know that why? We will never part.
Bo-ba-do-bo-bo-bo.
Wow. Yeah. Great work, everybody. Troy, I love that little Motown outro thing. Super soulful.
Cool. Thanks, Lau. Yeah, just came to me, so I went with it.
Wow. It's crazy.
Hey, is this where the a cappella group meets?
Oh, hey, Mark.
Hey, Lyle. What's going on, buddy?
Mark, get over here. Yeah, guys, this is my buddy Mark. He just transferred from Minnesota. I thought he could sit in on a few practices. I don't know. Maybe join the group.
Maybe.
All right, guys. Let's do Always Been My Girl again from the
always
top.
Always Been My Girl. Okay,
and
I know that, yeah.
Mark, show us your stuff.
You got it, man.
All right, guys. Ready? 1, 2.
Doom, 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 doom.
There goes the girl who owns my heart. I knew she was the one right from the start. Our love is here to stay each and every day. We know that we will never part.
Bo, ba, do, bo, bo, bo.
You gotta be kidding me. Mark was out of this world.
Gosh, okay, well, hey, it just came to me, so I just went with it.
Great. Well, keep going with it.
What is going on in this is the two of you basically being in this really incongruous place to be having a blackness contest.
Right, right. But it's our experience. It's actually me and Jordan's real life experience. That's what we gravitated toward because of the way we were raised and where we came from and how economics dictated our life and our upbringing. So that was a sketch that was really easy for our writers to write for us. Like that's an experience that – and also the people of color in our writings – on our writing staff, that's their experience too. Because in the world of improv, there's a preponderance of white males. And any producer, very often a producer will tell I had a friend who said, hey, what are my chances of getting on, you know, a resident stage at the Second City? This is years and years ago. And the president of the Second City at the time said, buddy, I got more than enough smart white guys. That's not what I need. I got a surplus of smart, snarky white guys of all shapes, sizes, and stripes. So I can't use you. You know, there's like 75 guys in line in front of you. But so that was the world that Jordan and I were in. And I think, you know, the extrapolation, of course, is the battle. But other than that, we always kind of banded together. The people of color always banded together in the improv communities that we were part of.
One of the big differences between Key and Peele and the shows to which it's often compared, which is like either African-American sketch shows, which generally means either in Living Color or Chappelle's show, or other sketch comedy things going on right now, especially sort of social commentary ones like Amy Schumer's show. I think is especially a big difference with Chappelle's show, which is probably the show to which it's compared the most often, is that, you know, I think Chappelle approached that show as a stand-up and hit every, you know, one of the great stand-ups of his generation.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the funniest dudes ever. But, like, hit every scene as a stand-up would, you know, pressing his personal voice that he's refined over that point, you know, 15, 20 years on stage.
Right.
And you and Jordan Peele tend to disappear into things. And it seems like you are very keen specifically to disappear into things.
First of all, what you said I think is completely accurate, that the stand-up mind works different than the actor mind. And I feel like because of my training as an actor, I don't know another way to do it. Like I don't know another way but to just become fully immersive and try to make sure that everything – I look at the sketches. The text of the sketches very often is sacrosanct to me. I think it's important to find and call character from these words. But people – when we hear people say – and they don't mean it to be pejorative. But when people say skit, it's like it's something you can just screw around with. And there are sketches you can screw around with, but there are sketches where you can really drill in. And so it's important to me to bring that aspect of acting to the pieces. To be a successful stand-up, you've got to be able to stand back a little bit and look at the world. And I've never been able to do that. I think it's because of my upbringing. My parents were social workers and all their friends were psychologists. So our whole life has always been about – but now walk in other people's shoes and see what their point of view is and where are they coming from. And I think that was helpful in making me want to be an actor. It's a skill set that I was learning from a very young age. Getting immersing in is what I like to do. I like to get in as deep as I can vocally, physically. Let's put – you know, let's slap some makeup on them and put hair on them so that it's as close as we can get to a fully realized human being in 4 minutes.
I'll continue my conversation with Keegan-Michael Key after a break. He'll pull back the curtain on the writing process behind Key and Peele and why the pair are choosing to bring the show to an end. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Bullseye is brought to you in part by Simple, banking for people who like to be treated like people. You'll never get hit with overdraft or monthly fees, and you can create goals and start saving automatically a little each day. You can visit simple.com/bullseye to see the way banking should be.
Thanks for listening to Bullseye this summer. NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is good conversation about the very best things to watch, read, and listen to. Minions, Smurfs, Trolls, oh my. Plus, the music in summer movies and Key and Peele's final season. Find something new to make you happy. Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Find it now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Emmy-nominated writer-actor Keegan-Michael Key. The final season of his TV sketch show Key and Peele is currently airing on Comedy Central. When you were making this show, I've heard you say that you very specifically thought, we want to make this in some way a black show. What did that mean for you?
We wanted to make it a black show, but also the more important thing, what it meant to me is I want to be able to show a bunch of different African-American experiences because the big danger is that there's a single story for the black experience. That's the danger. It's not true because African-Americans, just like Caucasian-Americans or Asian-Americans or Hispanic-Americans, we're not a monolith. I mean – So that was what was important to get on the screen, is different types, different parts of the African-American experience. I would never expect anybody to write from a place they didn't know. But because of the thing you had mentioned before, you said in this aggregate experience that Jordan and I have had, we've woven in and out of different experiences. We're like cultural referees in a way, but we're also participating in the game. So it's standing back and watching different cultural phenomena and then diving into it, because we're in a unique position where we can. And so I think that we wanted to have a mosaic of black experiences, and then you're still allowed to put that under the heading of the African-American experience, i.e. black. And so that was important to me because, look, we can't help it anyway, so we may as well embrace it. I have melanin in my skin, so if I open my mouth and I perform, I'm making some kind of racial statement whether I want to or not. So we may as well embrace it, and that's what we did.
It seems to me like one of the great challenges of anyone who isn't from, you know, the hegemonic cultural groups in entertainment is – you don't get a lot of chances at self-representation as a general rule.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, maybe if you're from a relatively large, small cultural group like African-American, you might get to make some things that are just for your group, or you might get the chance to do things that, you know, don't have a lot of cultural specificity, you know, like just be the second best friend on a sitcom or something like that. But it seems like it is super difficult to have a chance to do things that are both specific and varied, that are also not specifically exclusively for an African-American audience or whatever cultural group it is.
Yeah. I feel like we've been given the opportunity to do that, though. And I feel like we have. The funny thing is, very often what we're observing is referential stuff about an era that everybody on the staff and Jordan and I are from, an era that we're from. So if you think about the Reginald Vell Johnson sketch, you know, where he's like, how is Urkel becoming the more famous, you know, this was supposed to be my show. This was supposed to be the working class Cosby show. What's happened?
I'm going to stop you here and we're going to listen to a little bit of this sketch. So basically in this sketch, what is happening is the producer of Family Matters is in his office, and we hear Reginald Vell Johnson, the nominal star of the show, and then Urkel enters.
Did I do that? Jaleel. Jaleel? There is no Jaleel. Only Steve. It's always been Steve. Give me Kanye! Forgetting something, Carl.
Don't you come near me. Stay away from me here.
Could have all been so simple, Carl. Just say your lines and take the money.
You monster! What are you doing? I can't control.
Doing this?
No, 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 no. See, I'll do anything.
You will do what I want on Family Matters.
Yes. Oh, of course, Steve.
See you on set, Carl.
Get out of my house, Steve!
That's one of those experiences where the sketch happens to involve African Americans. That's kind of a signature thing that I think we do. But sometimes I don't think we think about it necessarily. Just one of the writers thought it was hilarious that he was reading old synopses of Family Matters plots. And he's going, these are real plots. These are real plots. Like, you know, Urkel and Carl were in a time machine. They went back in time. And then another Urkel, who was like a pirate, had come through a wormhole. Like, what is going on? This is ridiculous.
Reginald Vell Johnson. Like, I'm an actual actor. I have talent. I'm a human.
I'm a human being.
I'm a human man.
I'm a human man who has a perspective on the world. What is happening? Why am I in a science fiction show? When did it turn into a science fiction show? But it's still, it's a show that contains African-American characters. And so that's one of the scenes I think that has that type of specificity that you're talking about. But then we're trying to mine the human experience more than anything very often. It's just going, this is a sketch about vanity. This is a sketch about fear. This is a sketch about trying to look cooler than you actually are. And they just happen to have black people in them. But then the big revolutionary thing is like when we just don't talk about it and we do whatever we want. So we do something like Les Mis. Well, we're both men of color, but we don't care. We wanted to do this sketch. It was fun to us, so we're going to do it.
You guys played the Founding Fathers at one point.
Played the Founding Fathers in the Second Amendment sketch. Yeah. So it's just everyone says, you know, what is it like to do black comedy? I'm like, well, the thing is, but how do you categorize those two sketches that we just mentioned? Because we don't – in those particular cases, we don't care. It was the subject matter that was alluring to us. And so you just have to kind of – find a way to compartmentalize what's happening in the sketch.
I want to play another sketch from Key and Peele, and my guest is Keegan-Michael Key. He's currently Emmy-nominated in 5 categories. This is a sketch from season 4. So this character named Gary is invited to the home of a black family who's looking for advice on a gay wedding that's going to happen in their family. It's their cousin. And he is taking questions about what happens in a gay marriage. And so I think many of your signature characters, like this one, are characters who strain to remain reasonable.
Yes.
In extraordinary circumstances. Let's take a listen.
Now, none of us are gay. So I assume that we would all sit then in the straight section.
The straight section?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, the straight section, he means as opposed to the gay section.
No, there's no sections, guys.
But the gay people...
No. What you would just sit
and
on...
in the straight...
No, Larry, listen to
but
me.
But in the aisle.
You would just sit on the side of the person that you were friends with or that your family's members, just like in a straight wedding.
So we just guess who's gay.
Or not. You could just... Yeah.
We'll guess who's gay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Guess who... When in the ceremony do we sing Over the Rainbow?
That's so bad. You just heard Gary Anthony Williams and Lance Reddick, who were just everybody was phenomenal in this sketch. It's just one of my favorite sketches. Everybody brought their A game. They were stellar.
What's wonderful about the sketch, and it's one of my absolute favorites from the show and in general, is I like that, you know, your character is essentially offering a kind of cultural translation.
Yes, yes.
And... like, it's not about, like, at no point is it about these, like, as horrible as some of the things that these people say are, none of them are about them being hateful.
Right.
It's just this, it's like new levels of ignorance.
Right, exactly, right. And them trying to parse out the ignorance or figure a way through it. They're making an effort.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of it is it's the nature of a lot of the stuff we do. It comes from our improv background. All of our writers have an improv background, or the majority of our writers have an improv background. And so much of it comes from yes-anding, the concept of whatever anybody offers, you agree with it in the affirmative, and then you add on to that idea, which is hard to make our brains do that. But that's what an improviser does. You train your brain to do that.
Because basically, if you disagree with something that happens on stage, that's the end of the scene.
Nothing yeah, you know,
can go from
here,
there.
I wanted to give you this antique pen. That's
oh, this not isn't pen. This isn't a pen. This is a feather.
Right.
Well, that's the end of that scene.
Well, that's the end of that scene, yeah. So you have to accept it's a pen and then say, oh, my God, I didn't know that it was inscribed to blah, blah, blah. And then you go from there. But I think that has been infused in our staff. So the thing is, helping each other along is intrinsic to the work that we do. So as opposed to them, yeah, it's those levels of ignorance. They're trying to achieve something together, as opposed to just name calling, which you see in a lot of comedy. You know, is name calling. So we're trying to achieve something as opposed to name calling, and that becomes a kind of a touchstone of the work that we do.
Sometimes on Key and Peele, my guest, Keegan-Michael Key, and his partner on the show, Jordan Peele, just act weird and dumb. I want to play a clip from the new season. These characters are probably the weirdest on the show, which has some real weird characters. It's kind of hard to describe how these guys look. So there's just kind of a regular Joe businessman sitting on an airplane. And these two guys get on, and it's really hard to describe how they look. Like, if you imagine on Keegan-Michael Key's head, half a wig plus like the back half is a wig with sort of just like regular finger waves and then like a lattice work of curls.
On my forehead, of braids, of small tight braids.
Oh, are they braids?
They're
okay,
little, they're little itty bitty braids. Yeah, it's really, yeah.
Like it looks sort of like a fishnet stocking of hair.
Right, right, right.
Only on the front half of his head. That'll give you some idea of how weird looking they are.
And of course, Jordan's hair is a hat.
Yes,
his hair is a hat.
Yes, somehow there's that famous viral photograph of the like young lady whose hair has been shaped into a helicopter.
Right. Yes,
and it is not unlike that, although it is a natural. So it's like if you took a big afro and topiaried it into a baseball cap.
That's exactly what his hair looks like.
Yeah. You know what?
We gonna Drax, and Sklounce.
I think what my partner's trying to say is if any Terrys come up in here, we gonna get our Bergeron. Did something happen or did I miss something as hypothetical?
Oh, we gonna definitely drop some hypotheticals on that Terry's clavicle, because I'm talking about squeeds, 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 squeeds.
Don't you just wish, though? Don't you just wish in your heart of hearts some Terry would come up in here trying some grab ass and the touchy-feely?
That's the opposite of what I want to have happen on a plane.
Okay. That's unfortunate. Conference.
The grab ass and touchy-feely gets me every time because it's something my dad – I said, Jordan, say this. Because it's something my dad used to say to me and my brother if we were acting up in the back of the car. I'm sick of it and I'm done. I'm done with it. I will pull it over. You guys are back there with the grab ass and the touchy feely, and I've had it. How do you expect us to take you seriously when you say such things?
Like, where does a sketch that is that silly? I mean, I should also mention that at some point they establish that Terrys is what they call airplane terrorists.
Yes.
It's like a familiar nickname for terrorists.
Right.
How do you even develop it? What is the pitch for that sketch?
Those characters were repurposed from another sketch that was equally as weird but a little creepy, and it's why we could never do the sketch. Their names were Mikkel and Starper. And Starper Clydesman and Mikkel I can't remember how to say his last name, but they were like two guys that wanted to do a camp. This is so creepy. They wanted to do a camp, like a theater camp for kids. And they both wore loose-fitting kind of gauzy white linen uniforms. They had a white van. And they're like, come on down to the camp. You can take a little bit of your day off for the summer, and we'll teach the children skills that they can use for the rest of their life. We'll even come and pick them up in our van. And they're standing around. Why? And then at the end of the course, like, why will no children come to the camp? They clearly don't understand that they look like child molesters. And so those characters were sitting on the back burner for a long time. And then the woman who runs our hair department was literally – for 2 years, she just kept on showing me pictures of this guy with hat hair, with the hair she topiaried into the hat. She's like, Keegan, we've got to do this. And then she showed me the picture. I look exactly like a real human being, my character, exactly like a real human being. The teeth, the plucked eyebrows, the whole nine yards. And then our writer, Colton Dunn, was writing this sketch, and he likes to give nicknames to a thing. So he's the person who says, we're going to call him Terry's, you know what I mean? Or, you know, that's the ball whack, you know, whatever the word is that he's, you know. And so he likes to kind of codify things. And so he wrote that, and we're like, you know what? We could make this Starper and Mikkel, and then it won't be anywhere near as creepy. And then Amanda, our hair woman, she just went, oh, and then can I do those the hair? And I'm like, this would be the sketch. This would be the sketch. And that's why, I mean, you know, the lack of the eyebrows, they're crazy. But we need, I mean, it's like a valve for us. We need some of those frivolous scenes to exist. Because in that same episode is the scene with the, you know, with the cop, you know, like the rule is if a black man has something in his hand, it's a gun. And so, you know, it's almost arch. It's very powerful, you know. And so you need that palate cleanser, I think, as well, in the body of any given program.
So, Keegan, you've announced, or you and Jordan have announced, that the fifth season of Key & Peele is going to be the last season of the show.
Yeah.
And I was listening to an interview that you did on the Nerdist show a few years ago. I mean, it was like literally maybe the second season of the show with Chris Hardwick and Jonah Ray and Matt Myra. And the two of you were unanimous in saying even then, look, if we have the chance to be a meteor, we would rather be a meteor that passes through the sky than something that becomes an institution.
Right. Yeah. And I think I wouldn't want – I'm trying to think of the word I'm looking for. But yeah, I wouldn't want people to say, oh, that's just a thing that we do because we're Americans. We watch Key and Peele. That's just a thing that we do. It hasn't really been good since the third season or the fourth season. Being the meteor is the more important – I think the more important thing. If you can be a phenomenon and then try to create a new phenomenon on down the road, it's why when you look at the careers of certain people like James Dean, not by his own volition, you know, was a meteor. And we don't have any idea what the work would be afterwards. And Jimi Hendrix, we don't know what the work would be. So they capture our imaginations because we can always dream about what would be.
So are you guys going to die in a car accident or drug overdose?
Well, it will be.
Move to Africa?
We might do all three. I'd just drive a Porsche. Yeah. Really on the Serengeti as fast as we possibly can with needles hanging out of our arms. That would be great. but that's a good movie. I like that idea for a movie. That should be the first scene in a movie. Why is that guy driving in a Porsche with a needle hanging out of his arm with his best friend screaming in the past? Are they on the Serengeti? How does that movie end? I'd like to see that.
Well, Keegan, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye again. It was great to get to talk to you.
You too, Jesse. I love coming here. This is great.
Keegan Michael Key is one of the co-creators and stars of Key & Peele on Comedy Central. He's got nominations in 5 different Emmy categories this year, including Outstanding Variety Sketch Series, Writing for a Variety Series, Writing for a Variety Special Short Format Live Action Entertainment Program, and Supporting Actor in a Comedy. He's also on the delightful sitcom Playing House, which is on USA.
Yep.
And is just one of the most pleasant things you could do with half an hour of your life. Thank you, Keegan.
Thank you.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. On The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Titus Burgess plays a struggling Broadway actor. He's desperately needy, demanding both attention and money from the show's title character. He sings at the drop of a hat. He's transparently conniving and manipulative. But he's also sweet, charming, and just super lovable. He shows his tough past and his lonely circumstances, and he's a real friend. That warmth comes from my guest Titus Burgess, who's been nominated for an Emmy for the role. Burgess was himself a struggling Broadway actor once upon a time, living in a basement apartment in Harlem, just like his character, although I don't think he took in any women escaping from underground sex cults like his character does on the show. Here's a scene from the first episode. Kimmy Schmidt, played by Ellie Kemper, has moved to New York and moved in with Titus, but she is completely naive. She's never lived in the big city, but she also, as I mentioned before, just got out of an underground sex cult. So she doesn't really know about anything. In this scene, she's devastated because her backpack got stolen, and inside it was her life savings.
Get your things and go home. New York City is not for you.
You don't understand.
Oh, I do understand.
But Titus...
Girl, my name is not Titus. My name is Ronald Wilkerson. I came here in 1998 on a damn bus from Chickasaw County, Mississippi. You know who leaves Chickasaw County? Nobody. Have you ever met a person from Mississippi?
No. But I haven't met anybody.
My point is, this was me then. I was cute, just like you. Showed my teeth when I smiled, just like you. I changed my name to Titus Andromedon, and I marched myself into audition for The Lion King.
You were in The Lion King on Broadway?
Yes, except I was not. I auditioned for The Lion King 20 times in 15 years until they finally told me you were not passing as a straight giraffe.
But you are such a good singer. I heard you.
I have not sung in public in 3 years. You want to know what I do now? I dress up in that robot costume in Times Square and I pass out flyers for an arcade. My boss is 17 years old. I get paid in quarters and I'm starting to think cab drivers are hitting me on purpose.
Well, you got out of Mississippi.
Escaping is not the same as making it, Kimmy. I'm very scared to ask you this.
Yes, there was weird sex stuff in the bunker.
Let me finish. How much money was in your backpack?
$13,000.
No, 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 no! Why?
Titus Burgess, welcome to Bullseye. It is really great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Jesse.
There's a lot going on in that scene.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, there are obvious parallels in this character's life and yours, although I hope that you're not quite as sort of venal as Titus on Unbreakable is. But I want to start with where you're from. You're not from Mississippi, but you are from outside Athens, Georgia.
I am.
I wonder if you could tell me about, you know, where you're from and just kind of the circumstances of your childhood.
Let's see. You got that correct. I was born in Athens, Georgia, but lived outside of Athens, Georgia in a little town called Winterville for most of my life. My family, everyone's still there. I'm the only oddball that decided to pick up and move to New York. I was raised in a very large extended family, lots and lots and lots of first cousins, but I'm an only child. My mother later married. Now I have two stepbrothers. But most of my upbringing was me by myself entertaining myself and entertaining my family and whatnot. You know, it's a familiar story. I'm sure other entertainers have experienced this sort of self-talent cultivation kind of thing.
Where did you sing as a kid?
Oh, church. My mom could sing. So we would do little duets at church all the time. And the church was deep, deep, deep into the woods in Stevens, Georgia, this long, winding dirt road, and takes about 40 minutes off of the main highway to get to. And that is where most of my past points of references in terms of my musical roots started. And that's what we would do, and I would listen to her sing, and she would play her Natalie Cole albums, and who else did she listen to? Luther Vandross, of course, Whitney Houston, and I would just sort of sing along with her and all those albums, and that's how I kind of developed my musical tastes, I would say.
When you were like a middle schooler or a teenager, did you think of yourself as gay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I knew in elementary school, buddy, very early on. I knew that I liked men, boys, but I didn't know that that's what it was called. I just knew I had zero interest in girls outside of playing jump rope with them.
I wonder, like, what did you know about what that meant? Even when you were more sophisticated, you know, even when you're 16 or 15 or 16 or something like that.
I knew that that meant that it did not follow the model that was set for us in this country, particularly, you know, where anything other than friendly feelings was, you know, frowned upon. I knew that you know, all of my peers had little girlfriends or whatever. My guy friends all had girlfriends, and I never did. And I never attempted to, I never tried to, and I never wanted to. I wanted to be close to them, but I don't know that I thought that I had to call it something until I began to express it more and was then told subsequently that this is an incorrect way to live. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I'll finish my conversation with Titus Burgess after a break. We'll talk about the time he was on stage on live television on the Tony Awards and his microphone broke. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Jesse here. So NPR is going to be taking over the Bullseye podcast feed starting in September. You will still be subscribed, but if your podcast preferences are set to download all new episodes, warning, you might find that your podcatcher tries to download our entire back catalog. So if you want to avoid that, it's pretty simple. You just need to switch your podcast app to download the most recent episode or the most recent three episodes or whatever is your preference, just not all of them for a minute, because otherwise you're going to get 800 downloaded. Anyway, sorry for the inconvenience. It's the only good way for us to make this transition over to NPR servers and keep our back catalog available to you, which a lot of folks wanted. So, yeah, thank you.
for listening to Bullseye this summer. NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is good conversation about the very best things to watch, read, and listen to. Minions, Smurfs, Trolls, oh my. Plus, the music in summer movies and Key & Peele's final season. Find something new to make you happy. Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Find it now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Titus Burgess. He's nominated for an Emmy for his performance as Titus Andromedon on the Netflix show The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. I want to play a clip from of you performing one of your first big roles on Broadway. You were in a revival of Guys and Dolls, and I'm going to say 2009. Does that sound right to you?
That's correct.
And you sang one of the signature songs from the show, and it's, you know, one of the great shows. And you got to perform it on the Tony Awards.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Well, let's take a listen to it a little bit. And I'll say ahead of time, as you listen to my guest, Titus Burgess, performing Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat on the 2009 Tonys, your radio isn't broken, and neither is our clip playing back equipment.
Dream. Am I going in with it?
I'm going.
And by some chance, I had brought my dice along, and there I stood, and I hollered, "Someone feed me!" But the passengers, they know right from wrong.
What a nightmare.
Yeah, we hear someone. Oh, literally over the TV audio somehow, bringing in a microphone to cover for the fact that the microphone that was on your body was, as we heard, sounding awful.
Yeah.
Could you hear
that it wasn't working?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you this. I had this feeling. Okay. I had to wear this fat suit. I was a lot smaller in those days. And I could feel the mic pack. I could feel through the suit, and I could feel that it was not secure. But I've never been to Radio City. Maybe this is a different device. Maybe, or at the time, I had never been. You know, so maybe I didn't know what I was talking about. So I didn't say anything. But I had a feeling that this thing was not all the way plugged in. And when it started, I thought my worst nightmare has come true. And also, when you do the Tonys, your dress rehearsal is filmed just in case there are technical difficulties when it airs live. So I thought, oh, well, clearly they have transferred over to our recorded rehearsal for the people at home, and the continuation of this performance is strictly for the people inside Radio City Music Hall. It wasn't until I got finished with the performance and got my phone out and had all these missed calls and texts and such, and people were like, oh my God, what happened to your microphone or whatever? And then I freaked out. I wasn't nervous while it was happening. I freaked out after the fact.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Titus Burgess. You might know him from his appearances as DeFuan on 30 Rock or as Titus Andromedon in the Netflix original show The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. He's been nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy. As you were getting ready to be on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, a role that I was written for you, although I'm sure, you know, since you're not the star of the show, I'm sure you had to go through some auditioning for anyway. I wonder if you were thinking about, if you were being conscious of, I want to do this character, but I don't want to be gay best friend.
Oh, absolutely, man. I never have any interest in that gay best friend or just best friend who's black sidekick, which is so often a visual stereotype, if you will, that we see in comedies, and it almost looks like an afterthought. It almost looks like a just to appease. I thought, you know, there's so much more we can say and do with this man than draw attention to the fact that he's gay, because, you know, it's not a circus. It's not step right up and watch this man be effeminate and let's giggle at how strange it is. You know, it's he is more every man than not. He is unemployed. He is a part of a socioeconomic demographic that is at the bottom and or next to non-existent. He is someone who's not been able to realize his dreams. He's not an Abercrombie and Fitch a model. You know, he is part of a culture that promotes you being as thin as you can. He's part of an industry that promotes being a certain size. So there are so many things stacked against him that would make delicious tension and create far more interesting storylines than who he decides to sleep with. So to answer your question is yes, I had no interest in playing the gay best friend.
What kind of choices do you think you can make as an actor? I mean, you don't write the show. What kind of choices do you think you can make that make it the kind of character that you want to play?
Well, no, you know, I don't write it, but I certainly inform it, and I certainly, you know, have Tina and Robert are very collaborative, and they listen, and they let me say stuff here and there about how I feel, you know, Titus should be played out. But they're also very sensitive and very culturally aware. So I don't have to do a great deal of recalibrating to make Titus be what people saw. It was very much thought out, although with me in mind, but long before I got there. And I just sort of sanded off the rough edges, if you will. But, you know, I can always, the actor or actress can also always say a line differently, give it a different intention. You know, subtext is one of our greatest allies. So there's so many things that can be done, so many ways to play and say a single sentence, a single word. You know what I mean?
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Titus Burgess. You might know him from his appearances as DeFuan on 30 Rock or as Titus Andromedon in the Netflix original show The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. He's been nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt has tried to engage with the kind of cultural breadth of New York, which is its center. And that is one of the themes of the show, being is that the protagonist is a woman who comes from almost an absence of culture, not because she's like a traditional Midwestern naif, but more because she lived in an underground bunker for 8 years.
Right. She was removed from culture. Sure.
And so, yeah, so she doesn't know anything about the world. And she's in New York, this place that is a, you know, a cauldron of a thousand cultures. That has been, you know, slightly problematic because it's hard to write about those things when you're writing a big show like this, you know, a big, broad, cartoony, jokey show. It's hard to muscle in the specificity that's required. But I think the show's done a really interesting job of using that kind of specificity and using the arc of the season to transform stereotypes into commentary. And one of the smaller instances of that is this arc for your character where he has been working at a theme restaurant. And it's like a Broadway theme restaurant, and his character is a werewolf. And so he doesn't take off his costume after work one day, and he's sort of lurching around the city. Let's take a listen to Titus Burgess on The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
So, how's your day?
Walking around New York dressed like a werewolf got weird.
Why? Mr. Burgess!
Oh, no, 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 no.
cab. I was just waving. I didn't do anything.
Nice day, huh, sir?
Can you hold my baby?
I got treated better as a werewolf than I ever did as a black man.
It's really... It's something.
It's a great joke.
It's a great joke.
It's also, I mean, it's also a really kind of a powerful, yeah, unfortunately, yeah, indeed.
That's exactly, yeah.
It's also kind of a powerful thing, you know?
It is a powerful thing, buddy. It's one of the reasons why I'm so proud of our show and the sensitivity with which we handle the political cultural climate in this country. But I think they are so smart about it. It's not heavy handed. In it, if you aren't really, really paying attention, it's just sort of like a drive by. Well, that's a poor choice of words. It's just sort of zips past you. You know, they don't call attention to it, but they certainly talk about it. And, it's handled with such care, but that was a great episode. I loved that one.
Do people talk to you about playing this character that is, I mean, on the one hand, so big and broad and jokey, as everything on the show is, but also that represents a real specific group of people to which, you know, in real life you also belong, and does it in a way that there hasn't been a lot of representation?
There hasn't been a lot of representation that has treated us like real human beings, capturing both our eccentricities as well as the subtle parts of all of us that make us most human. And I certainly am not desirous of hoping to walk around being praised and lauded for pioneering or anything strange like that. But I am excited that I can hold my head up and be proud of the work that we're doing, and that it represents a part of my culture so well. And I would even say it represents an even smaller subculture that is more often ignored than not. You know, there aren't a lot of gay out black men that are talked about on television, let alone celebrated. So I think this is, it treats it with sensitivity. I think it's smart, and I think it I think she captured it wonderfully. I really do.
We've come to the portion of our interview where we talk about Pinot Noir.
Oh, Lord.
it's one of the best things, basically. I think we'll take a listen to it. So basically, the plot of this particular episode of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is that your character, whose name is Titus, and my guest is also named Titus, Titus Burgess, is making a low-budget music video trying to go viral and jumpstart his career. This song is called Pinot Noir, and he is of the belief that when one is making songs, the lyrics are not important as long as they rhyme. So let's take a listen.
Action! Pinot Noir! Myanmar, mid-sized car. You don't have to be popular. Find out who your true friends are. Pinot Noir. In the boudoir.
In the boudoir.
Then what's the voicemail? Call it again. Call it again.
Pinot Noir. Smoke a cigar. Revenge can be spectacular.
Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir.
I have to tell you, Titus, it's the first clip we've ever played on our show that has precipitated me having to write an email to the lawyers at National Public Radio that says, Dear lawyers at National Public Radio, very nice. Can you say an ode to black penis on NPR?
Oh, my God. Obviously, they said yes. Or are you going to edit this out?
They said they actually said no. This is if this makes the cut, it'll be on the podcast. But
okay.
I didn't want to not discuss it. But one of the really cool things about that is that joke. I mean, it's a great joke that the song is called Pinot Noir, and then he says it's because it's an ode to black penis. But also, I have to say, like, in watching it, that was, like, kind of an exciting thing to hear a black gay character say on TV, as ridiculous as it sounds. Just
the acknowledgement, the sheer acknowledgement.
Yeah, just acknowledging the sexuality of a black gay man in a way that isn't mocking or
derogatory.
Gross or
yeah.
It's kind of spectacular.
It is extremely spectacular, Pinot Noir. it is, but that's what I mean about Tina and Robert. Listen, man, like there's been several outlets that early on, you know, spoke about, you know, racial stereotypes and got some quote unquote backlash, albeit minimal and ridiculous. But I love that they don't shy away from the fullness of who he is. They let him be three dimensional. And it's New York. It is this gay black man who fully takes up the space that he inhabits, and perhaps other people's space as well. It's just so lovely to have all of him celebrated. And also, what I find so funny about it is we make the joke once, but then the song, although an ode or celebration of, actually, there's no allusion to it. We don't allude to it anymore, really, unless you are associating it with that every single time we say Pinot Noir. You know what I mean? So but that's what's so brilliant about the absolute ridiculousness of it all. But I couldn't agree with you more. It's lovely to watch, particularly in this climate, but that's another story.
Can I tell you, Titus, that was one of the things we had to address with the lawyers. It was like, well, if we leave out the ode to black penis part, then is that okay? And it turns out that because they say the ode to black penis part, that makes the rest of it about black penis, whether or not they say black penis or not.
Right.
And since you can't talk about penises in a sexual way, in a non-news or, medical context on the radio, legally speaking, we were out of luck.
Well, that's all right. Tell them to watch the show.
Does your character's signature song from season one make you more or less likely to order Pinot Noir when out and about?
I try not to do it in front of people because I don't like a lot of attention. That's how Titus and myself differ. I'm very introverted and I'm not very flashy and I don't enjoy going out and I've never had. I'd rather have you over to my house and I'd rather cook and play the piano and just hang out.
It's a deal. When are we going to do that?
Whenever you come to this coast, my friend. I drank Pinot Noir before this TV show, and I rather enjoy it. So I usually will have my partner order it for me, or or I'll just excuse myself and have him order it or something like that. Just so, because I don't want to seem presumptuous, and I certainly don't want them to feel any bizarre obligation to, give me a bottle on the house or something. And also, if they don't recognize me, I certainly don't want to give them a reason to recognize me because I'd like to be left alone. So I just kind of avoid it at all costs, or try and sneak it in on the down low.
Tydus Burgess, I really appreciate you taking the time to come beyond Bullseye. It was really great to talk to you. I'm such a fan of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and such a fan of yours.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun, man. Unbreakable. Stay alive,
baby. It's a miracle. Tydus Burgess. He's nominated for an Emmy for his performance as Tydus Andromedon on the Netflix show The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Every week on the show, we like to close with a recommendation from me. It's The Outshot. So I had a friend in college named Gene, and Gene swore up and down to me that Fletch was a great movie. I had sort of missed Chevy Chase's glory years. My earliest memories of him are from his TV show. I mean, I can vaguely recall liking The Three Amigos, but mostly I remember, if I'm honest, not understanding why he was a famous person. But this is what would happen when I would visit my friend Gene's dorm room. I would knock, and he'd yell for me to let myself in. And I'd open the door, and he'd be there on his computer, and he'd look up at me, and he'd smile impishly, and then he would click play on the MP3 of the theme from Fletch. And then he would say, "Jesse, time for some investigating." The immense pleasure that he took in this stupid song and this stupid idea was honestly pretty infectious. And so finally, one day, Gene convinced me to watch Fletch. I was absolutely sure it would be awful. And boy, was I wrong.
Excuse me, senor. You are a member of the club?
No, I'm not. I'm with the Underhills.
They are left, senor.
That's all right. They'll be back. He went out for his urinalysis.
Would you like some drinks, senor, while you wait? I will put it on the Underhills bill.
Yes, very good. I'll have a Bloody Mary and a steak sandwich and a steak sandwich, please.
Very good, senor.
Fletch is peak Chevy Chase, an actor at the apex of his completely nonplussed powers. In Fletch, Chevy Chase plays, basically Chevy Chase, a guy who has zero investment in anything around him and just kind of wants to goof around. This scene, which is right at the beginning of the movie, was apparently a big catalyst for Chase's characterization in Fletch.
I'll give you $1,000 cash. Just come to my house and listen to the proposition.
Does this proposition entail my dressing up as Little Bo Peep?
It's nothing of a sexual nature, I assure you.
Yeah, I assure you.
$1,000 just to listen? I don't see how you can pass that up, Mr.
Nugent. Ted Nugent.
I guess it should be said for clarity's sake that his character's name is not actually Ted Nugent. Anyway, as soon as Chevy Chase figured out that he could do something as stupid as tell someone his name was Ted Nugent, it was basically off to the races.
John Cocktoastone.
It's a beautiful name.
Well, it's Scotchermania.
Odd combination.
Yeah, well, so are my parents.
My name is Igor Stravinsky, and I'm calling about some ranch property I'd like to buy.
Name's Liddy. Gordon Liddy.
Oh, by the way.
What kind of a name is Boone?
Comanche Indian.
No, I'm sorry. Who are you again?
I'm Frida's boss.
Hey, who's Frida?
My secretary.
I've heard Chase's shtick described as smug, glib smartassery.
Everything a joke to you, Fletch?
Everything, Sam.
But it's not. It's basically bluffing. In Fletch, he's a weirdo whose game is to do the most ridiculous thing that he can think of and see if he can sell it as normal. That it's coming from this handsome, waspy, super straight dude, as far as I'm concerned, just makes it funnier. It's not about putting people down or even really making wisecracks. It's just a game of what's the dumbest thing I can do while maintaining a straight face.
Don't worry about the speed limit here. That's why we got the police escort.
You a cop?
As far as you know.
Are you gonna take me to jail for car theft?
Why, did you steal the car?
I sure did!
Well, I'm not even sure that's a crime anymore. There's been a lot of changes in the law.
Fletch has a fun sort of mystery plot, and it moves quickly enough, and there's good supporting performances, but mostly, it is just Chevy Chase thinking of new silly stuff to do. Chase, just like David Letterman, was sort of the father to anti-comedy. There's no Norm Macdonald without them, no Tim and Eric. He was just above and outside the world he inhabited, but also absolutely, assuredly running the show. For better or worse, he didn't do try-hard comedy. It's not John Belushi doing anything for a laugh. It seems effortless, and it's easy to dismiss for that reason. And, you know, it's harder to connect with than, like, Robin Williams, who's so sweet and working so hard for you. But there's something magical to me about Fletch telling someone his name is Igor Stravinsky, or pretending to drop files at a hospital desk over and over until a nurse is so confused that she tells him a vital clue, or actually until she speaks it into the end of a stethoscope he's holding up to her mouth.
Where's the record room?
Next to pathology.
Would you do me a favor and take care of these things? I'd like to check Alan Stanwyck's file. What the hell's happening?
Hey,
where the hell's the record room?
Next to pathology.
B1.
I can't hear you. What?
B1.
Could you just collate these for me? And where'd you say that was?
B1.
B1. Thank you very much.
You can take the elevator.
Thank you very much.
Maybe it's just a power fantasy, this idea that even as the world seems like it's falling apart around you, everything's actually going according to plan. You're, you know, dissolute and living on a beach and wishing you were a basketball player and behind in your child support, but actually you've got it all under control. That for once the little guy's in charge, and the little guy's name is Mr. Babar, and yes, that's spelled with one B in the middle, and no, he's never heard of a children's elephant of the same name. Must be a coincidence. Thanks, Gene. That's my outshot. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. The show's produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Production fellow at Maximum Fun is Ibarianex Perello. Senior producer is Colin Anderson. All our interstitial music provided to us by Dan Wally. Thanks to the Go team and their label Memphis Industries for our theme music. Thanks this week to Neil Rauch at NPR New York for his engineering help, and to Dr. Rosen Rosen for his help with the outshot this week. If you'd like to hear any of our past programs, they're all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And if this isn't enough cool culture stuff for you, you can check out our sister podcast, Pop Rocket. It's a roundtable discussion of everything great in popular culture, hosted by the brilliant and hilarious Guy Branum. This week, NPR Pop Culture Happy Hour's own Linda Holmes joins the team to discuss rom-coms and cement an alliance against the hated rival, Slate's Culture Gab Fest. It's a meeting of the families on Pop Rocket this week. You can find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts. Anyway, I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned.
Listener-supported.